From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Selma.
Rockridge.
Tracy, California.
Noe Valley.
Everywhere, I'm homeless.
Coming up, the Bay Area responds to atrocities overseas. First, a rally in San Francisco calls for the overthrow of the regime in Syria. Then an East Bay rally seeks justice in the case of a U.S. soldier who allegedly murdered Afghan civilians.
I guess we should all be satisfied, right? After all, President Obama did apologize and offer his deepest condolences to the families of those killed.
Also today, we'll meet a former soldier who wants to talk about PTSD, and later talk to a composer whose new opera is inspired by a real-life tragedy that took place in San Francisco just a few years ago. Spring rain has been sweeping the Bay Area. At this time last year, the world watched as revolutions swept across the Arab world. The uprisings ended decades-long dictatorships in the Middle East in what was called the Arab Spring.
It was frustration at Tunisia's youth unemployment that started it all. When 23-year-old fruit vendor Mohamed Bouazizi set fire to himself last year and died days later, it sparked an unprecedented wave of protests that would transform the region.
The Vice President Omar Suleiman said that President Hosni Mubarak has decided to give up his office and hand over authority to a high military council.
Despite the most brutal measures to suppress demonstrations, young people in Tunisia decided that today was the chance to overthrow a corrupt government.
This spring, as millions of people in Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, and Yemen celebrate the success of their revolts, the people of Syria are living a different story. Though they, too, took to the streets last spring, today they're still living under the regime of Bashar al-Assad. This week marks the one-year anniversary of the Syrian revolt. It's been a year of brutal crackdowns on the opposition.
Day after day, unarmed Syrian protesters have come out to face machine guns, snipers, and armored vehicles. The cost so far is 4,000 dead.
As the people of Syria fight or flee Assad's regime, Syrian Americans here in the Bay Area have rallied in support of the uprising. KALW's David Waldorf attended a protest last Sunday in Union Square and brings us this audio postcard from that day.
There is only one solution!
There is only one solution!
Revolution! Revolution!
My name is Javed Mirabdal, and I'm from Berkeley.
My name is Tariq Al-Saman. I was born in Aleppo, but was raised in Damascus for 26 years.
My name is Mustafa Masri. I came from Santa Clara.
Today we are here with a group of Iranian-American North Berkeley to support the revolution, the change for freedom and democracy in Syria.
All my family, my parents are still in Syria, my friends. I try to talk to them on Facebook, on Twitter, and wherever I hear there's something going on and near my parents' area, I try to call them to make sure they are fine.
Well, we are hoping that this kind of rally will get the attention of the people first, that there is a massacre going on in Europe, in Syria, and second, that people will call their representative in House and Senate and raise the issue that there is a massacre going on. We have to help the Syrian people.
To be honest, I don't think this rally will do anything except just showing solidarity and show Syrians inside Syria that people are in California and everywhere in the world. We are still thinking of them. They are in our hearts, and we wish they get their freedom soon.
Well, I hope this rally sends a strong message to, you know, my president, you know, Obama, to say, you know, the people of Syria have stood up against oppression and injustices. The same thing we did for Bosnia, we did for Libya, we did for other places. We hope, you know, peace can be brought to the people of Syria. We're not really asking, you know, extreme things. We're just asking equal rights, just like other people who live here, who live in Europe, who live in other parts of the world. So that's what I'm asking for, really, equality of life for all. You know.
Those were the voices of Javed Mir Abdul, Tariq Al-Saman, and Mustafa Masri. That audio postcard was brought to us by KALW's David Waldorf. listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Now we'll cross the bridge over to the East Bay, where another group of people were rallying this weekend. Afghan Americans held a protest and rally on Saturday afternoon in the Fremont neighborhood known as Little Kabul. Despite the rain, about 200 people waved Afghan and American flags to protest last week's massacre of 16 Afghan civilians in Kandahar, allegedly committed by U.S. Staff Sergeant Robert Bales. On either side of a large speaker stage hung huge photos of the victims' bloody bodies, including several children. One of the rally organizers, Weiss Haider, had a clear message for President Obama.
I guess we should all be satisfied, right? After all, President Obama did apologize and offer his deepest condolences to the families of those killed. But wait, I thought we heard that apology when our body parts were collected as war trophies. And I thought we heard it when Afghans were urinated on. Then again, when our holy book was reduced to ashes. With all due respect, Mr. President, your pre-scripted, recycled apologies for these atrocious acts carry no value after a decade of warfare and thousands of civilian casualties.
Brandon Ott, a former U.S. Marine, stood in a military jacket and says he wants the American people to connect more closely with what the military does overseas. I asked him what he hopes rallies like this will achieve.
I'm really hoping events like this can educate people that don't know about the Afghan community, their culture, and what's going on in their country. And I also hope it can eliminate that apathy and we can tell our government, no, we don't want this war anymore because it's crippled our economy. It's polarizing us as a country. It's creating xenophobia in this country. And it's also, above all of that, it's caused hyper-partisanship in this country. And we can't even agree on what we're going to do.
My name is Medina Omar, and I'm from Hayward, California.
Omar is Afghan-American and said, while some are calling for an immediate withdrawal from Afghanistan, she feels differently.
I understand we're there now. It takes a lot of planning and efforts and money to pull out now. You know, just looking at it politically, it's not as easy to pull out right away. It takes a lot of long-term planning to make sure that the security and the stability remains once you pull out. So my personal opinion is, you know, the focus should be on humanitarian efforts, providing social services, providing long-term services there that will stand once the troops do pull out.
One speaker, who identified herself only as Fatima, is a fiery young Afghan-American woman with a group called Afghans for Peace. Taking her place at the podium, she expressed doubt that any meaningful change can occur under the current political system.
If this was a time before the revolutions happening in the Arab world, I would understand that you still believe that you can vote and change the system. Unfortunately, by now, you should know that voting and trying to go through the political system is not going to end wars. This is a time when the Occupy movement is happening here in America. Americans are taking to the streets because they don't believe in the political system. I myself have been involved in Occupy openly when I was pregnant. I got beat up by the police. I got tear gas. I'm a Muslim Afghan woman, and if I'm putting my life and my baby on the line, you all should too.
I caught up with Fatima when she got off stage.
I'm here because from the moment 9/11 happened, my first fear in my mind was that they're going to go into Afghanistan and bomb the hell out of us. And by October, I was in New York resisting, protesting, joined the anti-war movement, and I've been doing that for the last 10 years. So it's very inspiring to see, despite the tragedy that happened, for the first time in 10 years, Afghans around the world are holding mass protests in many different countries. That's why I'm here today.
That was Fatima from Afghans for Peace. Preceding her were Weiss Haider, Brandon Ott, and Medina Omar. We'd like to hear your views on the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. How do you connect to the conflict? Call our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. One of the issues people are raising about the case of Staff Sergeant Robert Bales is whether he had post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. About 5,200 soldiers deployed to Afghanistan in the initial months following the September 11th attacks. Another 67,000 went to Iraq less than 2 years later. Over the years, those troop levels increased, and so did the number of soldiers who returned home bearing the scars of those wars. Today, it's estimated that there are over 99,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. For some soldiers, post-traumatic stress disorder really is a four-letter word. A PTSD diagnosis means you may need treatment for the rest of your life. It can deeply affect personal and professional relationships, and it often comes with a social stigma.
You're weak. You can't think that way. Oh, there's something wrong with you. You know, you're just trying to get out of the military, blah, blah, blah. It's totally unacceptable to say that you have mental problems. I won't even say problems. You're just having a hard time dealing with stuff.
Jeremy Prophet served in the Army in both Afghanistan and Iraq and came back with PTSD. Now that he's out, he has a new mission, to clear up misconceptions about the illness. Priscilla Yuki Wilson has his story.
Jeremy Prophet lives with his family in an East Bay suburb about 45 minutes outside of Oakland. He's in his weekend uniform when he greets me at his door. White t-shirt, jean shorts, flip-flops. They've just moved in and his wife is unpacking the kitchen as Prophet picks up his baby daughter, Ryland. He gently cradles her in his lap as he starts to tell me his story.
It felt gratifying. It felt like I was able to do my part.
Prophet joined the Army because he wanted to go into law enforcement. He signed up in July 2001, and he was still in basic training when 9/11 hit.
We had the TV on. We had a break at the end of the evening. We were all getting ready to crash for the night.
Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Oh, my God!
And so that was a huge impact to, you know, not only the world and everybody, but people that joined up. Okay, reality is we're probably going to go to war now.
The first strike against terrorism as a missile barrage lands on Afghanistan.
We will not falter, and we will not fail.
It didn't take long for all that pent-up energy to find an outlet. Prophet's unit was among the first to go to the Middle East. But when he landed in Afghanistan, he says things were still fairly calm.
Afghanistan was like a peace, to me, a peacekeeping mission. It wasn't very... We were there early on, so there wasn't a lot of the issues, unfortunately, that are going on today.
Prophet served in Afghanistan for 8 months and left in September 2002, unharmed. He says the first deployment felt right, felt justified. But then he was deployed again, to Iraq.
Again, you know, it's something I signed up to do. I'm going to go do it. It's my job. It was just a bad vibe. Plus, we're like, man, we just got back. We're going again. 3 months. That's all we had off is 3 months.
The trek to Iraq began in Kuwait. Prophet's unit was headed to the northern area of Mosul, where they would provide security for supply routes. He says that a lot of what he saw in Kuwait was like a Hollywood movie. The destruction and chaos he was used to seeing on film was now all around him. It didn't take long for him to become numb to it all.
I really didn't have any emotions, and that's the whole problem, is through this whole thing, there was no sad, there was no happy, it was just, the best way I could describe it is you're a robot.
On January 25th, 2004, Prophet was violently jolted out of his numbness. He'd been in Iraq almost a year.
And we were getting ready to turn right onto a bridge, and two IEDs go off.
IED stands for Improvised Explosive Device, otherwise known as a roadside bomb.
I was the supervisor of the NCO of the truck. My gunner was hit in the face with an explosion. So, and then the truck behind us, the gunner, she was hit in the neck, and it was, I think, a quarter of an inch from her main artery. And so she was bleeding like crazy. So the first thing I say is, everybody all right? My driver says, he's all right, but we're coughing. I look up and I yell at my gunner. I said, you're all right. He doesn't say nothing. I say, are you all right again? And then I hear him choking and coughing, and I look up and there's just blood everywhere. And all you see is, you know, half his face is just, there's a hole in it.
Prophet and the other soldiers got the gunner to the base hospital in time to stabilize him. He was sent to Germany for further care and survived. But Prophet says after that day, he felt a horrible rage. It was the first time he was able to feel any emotional response. He had watched his colleague's face be blown off, and he had to go back to work the next day. Prophet was honorably discharged in March 2004, but he says his experiences in combat followed him. He calls it the war at home, and his family and friends fight it with him.
His mom started noticing changes too, and she started saying stuff to him, and yeah. So did his stepdad and his sister.
That's Prophet's wife, Lindsay.
Finally, after a while, he's like, you know what? If they're all saying it, something's got to be different.
You know, I always joke with him. I said, maybe you need to go get help for PTSD, because and I hate even using it. It's like a horrible word, but it's, again, it drives me nuts that when they associate PTSD with veterans as negative, but anybody could suffer from PTSD.
Prophet was diagnosed with PTSD a year after his return home.
So that was a huge problem. You don't have any feelings because you're trying to survive. You don't know what emotion is. You don't want to get happy because you're used to being in a weird mindset for a while. Always had to have things in my hands to take my mind off of stuff. I had to just go in 100 miles an hour. I couldn't hold a conversation.
It took a year for him to finally reach out for help because
we're not trained to ask for help.
Prophet says everyone handles PTSD differently, but everyone who's been in combat deals with it.
I think anybody that deploys, whether you fired your weapon or done anything, it will alter your life because of the stuff you see. If you come back from a deployment and don't feel differently and you think everything is the same, you know, you're wrong.
Prophet had a lot of support from his family, something he says not all veterans have. He says things are getting better, even though he can't shake the stigma that comes along with his diagnosis.
I thought I would never get a job. That's why I never really talked about it. And finally, I was like, you know what? I accept it. It's a fact of life. It's not going to control my life. And if you're not going to hire me because of I serve my country and I have some stuff that I have to take care of, that's their loss and not mine.
If he could, Prophet would change one thing about the military, how it takes care of its soldiers when they come home.
We need to be proactive and not reactive. It's great. We have tons of funding. We have tons of services. But a veteran's not going to walk into the doors and say, hey, I need help. It's not reality. I didn't walk in and say, hey, I need help. It took me a year to figure out, well, there's something different.
The difference now, he says, is that he knows he can get past those feelings. And he wants other veterans to know they can get past them, too. For Cross Currents, I'm Priscilla Yuki Wilson.
You can hear that and all our stories online at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Whether we're dealing with a violent struggle against a dictator or a debilitating illness, artistic expression is one way we find comfort in tragedy. San Francisco composer Erling Wald's new chamber opera, Certitude and Joy, opens this week. The opera is a semi-autobiographical work that mixes Wald's personal struggle with religious faith with a real-life San Francisco. Wald is a renowned composer. His pieces have been played from the Bay Area to Bulgaria. He's also an accomplished computer scientist with multiple software patents to his name. KALW's Jen Chien spoke with Erling Wald about how he balances art and science and about the effort to make meaning out of tragedy through music.
You're extremely accomplished in both your musical career and also your computer career. So what is the ratio of each kind of work that you're doing now?
It's about half and half. You know, I kind of more or less work two full-time jobs.
And have you been half and half for your whole career, would you say?
A long time. Yes. Decades. Many decades.
So can you say maybe what a typical work week would look like for you? What days do you spend? How much part of your day do you spend on each thing?
Yeah, it's funny. For all that time, fortunately, in the engineering world that I am in, time is fairly flexible. So I have always done both kind of all the time. I don't tend to do one thing and then switch to the other. It's all mixed up.
And is the giving up the day job, or not being able to give up the day job, is that about financial considerations?
Right, greed.
Mm-hmm. And yet...
Well, it gives me a lot of opportunities that are, you know, I have a lot of artist friends, and I've seen how a lot of them have dealt with this issue, because it's an issue for everybody. How do you deal with finances? You know, and some people just eat beans and rice all the time, and they do their art, and that's not an avenue that's been... I'm capable of. I don't think. You know, it's easier maybe when you're 20. I mean, when I was young, I did do the first thing. I mean, I just lived very simply. But I have a family. I mean, I have a child. I have to deal with all of that stuff.
You grew up in a religious family. Your father was a minister.
Right.
Your mother spoke in tongues sometimes. You yourself rejected religion at a certain point.
Yes and no. I mean, that's really what this opera is, kind of a personal piece. A lot of my operas have been about, have touched on subjects of religion and issues around it. My parents were both extremely involved in Lutheran Church and in Christianity. I mean, I was raised in the midst of that, and they were very liberal minded. I mean, I loved them and I respected them, and I understood that motivation. I loved what they did, but I couldn't quite get it, and I was really torn up about it. I mean,
that you didn't get or couldn't get?
Well, I think it was a lot because I was in this rational science world. I really saw that divide. You know, it didn't. I wanted it. I wanted that comfort that they had, that sureness about the world. But I was very nervous about it. It felt crazy to me.
So let's talk about your new opera, Certitude and Joy.
Right.
So you said it does deal with themes of religion and faith, but
right.
It was also based on a real life event, a
right.
tragic event that happened
right.
here in San Francisco in 2005.
Right.
Can you talk about the inspiration for the piece?
Yeah. I mean, I had heard about this incident when it happened, this woman who killed her 3 children by throwing them off Pier 7, LaShawn Harris. Heard voices, was instructed by God, as far as she was concerned, and she had psychological issues, and she was quite religious, and one day she was told by God to take her children to San Francisco and to give them to him. You know, when she talked about it later, it was a bit confused, but more or less, she took them to San Francisco, they spent the day sightseeing, they had hot dogs, they went to Pier 39, they came to Pier 7, they watched the people doing things, and then this certain time came where she knew she had to do this, and she kind of ritually undressed each of them and threw them in the water. It's this immense tragedy. You know, it's unbelievably horrifying. You even read, I read a number of the court documents and such, and there's moments, you know, where people talk about what happened, and you just can't even handle it. I worried a lot about the kind of sensationalizing this tragedy. But really, I want to talk more about the way it affected me, because I came across this. It started making me think about my youth and these worries I had, which were really kind of strong. I mean, when I was young, I actually have to say, I mean, I was, maybe it's because I was a smart guy and such, I was a little worried about being different and being kind of on the edge of going crazy anyway. I mean, maybe a lot of people feel that way, who feel kind of on the outside. And religion was a big part of it. Obviously, it's why I keep coming back to it. So in this piece, I mix up her story and mine. It's factual in some ways, but it's definitely fantastic in a lot of ways. You know, it's not intended to be just her tale. It's intended to be discussion of these events and the issues that it brings up for me.
Do you think of it as an artistic response to the event rather than a documentary or a retelling of the event?
Yeah, it's definitely not just a documentary of the event.
So this story that we're talking about, the story of LaShawn Harris, it is a very dark and tragic story. How do you as an artist take a story that is so dark and attempt to make beauty out of it? Or is that, in fact, what you're trying to do as an artist?
I do. I have to say, I do try to make some kind of beautiful experience. Maybe it is to make sense of it. I mean, there's some way all of us try to make sense of it. Even reading the legal documents around the case, you know, there's this tendency of the legal machinery to try to categorize and classify and lay it out as so that we can kind of understand it, even though it's not understandable. It's really unexplainable. And so maybe it's a similar reaction to that. It's wanting to put it into this place where I can kind of look at it as a thing and make sense of it and maybe present it to other people and try to make sense of it in some way.
Certitude and Joy opens this Thursday and runs through April 1st at Bindlestiff Theater in San Francisco. For more information, you can go to KALW.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Martina Castro, Jamie Katsoufis, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Emily Gaddick, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, RTM's Konahovs, Casey Miner, Nina Morente, Erica Mu, Rena Palta, and Steven. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.